For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, Mr. Mark Tuttle, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. Gentlemen, we've got past the holidays. We've now moved into ordinary time, which gives us the opportunity to kind of, you know, stretch out and take a look at what's going on in the world, what's going on in, you know, philosophy, theology, those kinds of fun things, if you consider those fun.
I do.
And
Mark does too. Kent, I think you like them.
There's a number of new books out there. Tim brought one in this morning.
Oh, yeah.
Called The Popes Against Modern Errors.
There are no modern errors, Tim.
And, and that's exactly where I want to go with this, because I saw the title of that book and all I could think of was, no, wait a minute. A while back, and this is several years ago, I read a book by the Venerable Archbishop Fulton J. Sheen called Old Errors and New Labels. It was published in 1931.
Oh, wow.
So what does this new book by, let's see, I can't read the name of it. Who is that?
Well, it's really more of an edit. It's more of a compilation.
Compilation. Okay.
Yeah, it's edited by Anthony Miani, M-I-O-N-I.
Okay. Right, because it's written by the popes, kind of.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So these are various...
Church documents, exactly. Encyclicals, that kind of stuff.
Okay, yeah. So these are gathered encyclicals by a number of popes. And, you know, this book is putting it out as if it's, you know, something new. Is it really? Or are we looking at, you know, errors that have happened throughout the centuries that, you know, we as, you know, unfortunately less informed Catholics today are looking at and saying, oh, well, that's not wrong.
Yeah, you know, there certainly seems to be a cycle of heresy. You know, when you look at a heresy, it kind of seems to come up, erupt, gain a lot of acceptance, and then the error starts to kind of crash in on itself, and then it disappears until it reappears again in a different form. And so there's this ongoing cycle of a lot of the early heresies that they just kind of keep rearing their heads.
They sure do. And so what's really valuable I'm finding about this particular book, The Popes Against Modern Errors, is that they've done all the editor's done all the heavy lifting for us. So they've really combed through a couple of hundred years worth of various church documents, encyclicals, those sorts of things, statements, proclamations, and then categorized them and then grabbed, you know, sections of those for our reflection and things to look at. So I thought it would be fun, entertaining, but also informative to kind of see with our, you know, here it is 2020, right? Beginning of a new decade, a fifth of the way into the new millennium, to kind of see with our contemporary,
with our 2020 vision,
our 2020 vision and hearing, with our 2020 hearing, how do some of these, maybe some of these errors that previous popes have called out, how do they sound to us now? And are they still valid? Are they not valid? Lessons to be learned?
Exactly. There's a lot packed into that because, you know, there's this notion of development of doctrine. And so, you know, as doctrine develops, to what extent do these errors become things that have been reconsidered, rethought, understood in a different light, you know, and therefore...
And can they even change? If you really identify them as an error, can an error really be updated or evolve or develop into something that's no longer an error? Because what's the opposite of an error? It must be true.
Right, exactly. So, you know, are these...
So that would be hard to see.
Right. But once again...
But let's see.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, once again, what would be harmful to a little baby sapling is not necessarily going to be harmful to a full-grown oak tree. And okay. So, you know, I think you got that question in mind.
Ooh. You know, I love the acorn to the mighty oak analogy anyway about nature. So, all right, good. All right, so where do you want to, how about this? I'm going to, let me throw this out there. Why don't we start with, just because it's a nice compression, this is sort of towards the beginning of the book. I like this section here. We're going to look at the syllabus of errors.
Right, and now this is important. What year was the Syllabus of Errors distributed?
So it was, the year is 1864.
Okay.
And it's issued by Blessed, Pope Pius IX, and actually on December 8th.
Okay.
Which is interesting because that's the solemnity of the Immaculate Conception, of which he was the one, he was the Pope who infallibly proclaimed the truth of the Immaculate Conception. So it's very, very helpful. So why don't I pick one, or let's start with one and kind of see where it leads us. How's that sound?
That sounds fun.
Okay, here we go. Here's one. Okay, this is under a section called Modern Rationalism. And the error goes like this. See if it even sounds like an error, though. As human reason is placed on a level with religion itself, so theological must be treated in the same manner as philosophical sciences.
Ooh, there's a lot there to discuss, to kind of unpack that. So as human reason is placed on the same level as religion?
Well, theology, I think.
It's theology.
And I would assume they're specifically talking about Catholic theology.
Right. So now here's the right. Mm-hmm. And that part I would definitely see the error in. You know, if you're placing human reason at the level of divinely revealed truths.
That's a problem.
Right. And your first principles are going to be wrong. So, you know, when you reason to something, you can come at it two ways. You can either come at it from what's already known and then reason towards the unknown, or you can come at it from the other direction and start kind of moving from, you know, sort of what's unknown towards what's known to kind of verify it. So, but either way, you need a firm first principle. A lot of times that comes from, you know, what we can empirically know, but it also comes often from principles of another body of knowledge, something else that somebody else has discovered or that's been well thought out. And theological truths, they originate from what's been divinely revealed to us.
Right.
And so if you put what is derived from reason on par with what is divinely revealed to us, you're gonna run into some errors.
Right. An example that comes to my mind might be, here's one. So Peter Singer, who's a very well-known professor of philosophy at Princeton University, is really known for kind of two things. One is his advocacy for animal rights, and sometimes that's considered he's argued what's been called at times an extreme position on that. But his other is also position on abortion, where he uses as I understand his position, he's using reason, his faculty of reason to make arguments for, and he's of he has full confidence in the conclusion that he's reached that abortion and infanticide can be justified. And so here's someone who I would say, so he's standing in that field of human reason, and he's reaching a conclusion that abortion and infanticide are justifiable. Well, I think this is a great example where theology could come along, which he excludes. He's not a man of faith, and he excludes theology, but theology would be very helpful because theology would show him that he's actually mistaken, and he's mistaken because, for example, it would one could quickly appeal, say, to the fourth commandment, which is the prohibition against murder, and if he were open to the correction that divine revelation would offer him, he would be able to then maybe rethink his position. So he's reached an error, objectively, I would say, about abortion and infanticide being justifiable. And what would help him out would have been theology, but he's excluded that from his conceptual framework.
And this brings up a good question. Are religious truths inherently irrational? In other words, if you start from something like the 10th mm-hmm. commandment, is that something that you just have to accept because that's the way it is and that's what God says? Or is there reason and rationality behind it?
Well, I'm going to go to, so I would say those aren't maybe quite the same thing. I think, so you could, so I do think religious truths ought to and should stand the test of reason. But just accepting something on revelation, there should be, that's sort of a blind faith argument. So that's a little bit different in my mind. But I'm going to point us towards something that's not in this book, and that is Fides et Ratio by St. John Paul the Great, where he really does take up quite magnificently in that encyclical the compatibility that one must find or will find and does find with faith and reason, that intersection of those two.
Right. And I think that goes back to kind of what we know about God. And we can even know this to a good extent through our own human reason, that God is not irrational, but God is super rational. So his rationality far exceeds ours. So in a way, you know, we can't talk about these things as rational truths because that puts God down on human level. And it's not that God's rationality is below human rationality, but that it's above human rationality. And so we can reason our way up and try to get as close as we possibly can to that, with the faith that, you know, ultimately, the further we go, it's going to continue to be more and more rational and more according to reason. But we may never actually get there.
I would say we can get there, but not in an exhaustive sense.
You just agreed with Hegel.
No, I agree with Vatican I.
Well, and
Vatican I is what I'm agreeing with, because in Vatican I, you know, I don't like Hegel that much. I mean, he's very interesting to read, but and maybe I'm fine because I know him well enough to really say if I'm agreeing with him or not. But where I'm coming from, what I'm standing on is Vatican I, that makes explicit in Vatican I that every human being, by the light of reason, can come to know the existence of God.
Exactly.
So I would say human reason, when we're using reason correctly, to ascend in truth, knowledge, understanding, wisdom, is a participation in God's reason or rationality. It's just that God, we only participate in a very limited way.
Exactly.
With that infinite reason that's
right.
God.
And that limitation keeps us sometimes, I think. And the limitations are going to vary person to person.
Right.
But that limitation sometimes keeps us from understanding the full rationality behind what's been revealed.
And yeah, well, so, sure. There's mystery, right? I would almost chalk it up as that. Right. Let me throw another one at you here. Oh, wait. Whoa, when we come back. Hey, that's what I call a teaser. So we're going to do another one when we get back.
Talking of limitations,
yeah.
Our limited time is out for this segment. We'll be back with more of The Catholic Cave right after this.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Welcome back to The Catholic Cave. I'm Timothy O'Donnell with Mark Tuttle, Kent Blanford. Today in The Cave, we are looking at excerpts from a really fun and helpful book. It's called The Popes Against Modern Errors.
See, this is a parlor game that you can play when you get friends over.
Absolutely.
Pour a couple of beers and then just...
Cigars.
And then just let them rip. Let the questions come.
Right. They're pulling... So it pulls from 16 papal documents. So this is really fun. So
you guys obviously hang with a different clique than I do.
Well, usually there's only two of us at these gatherings. Although we'd like more people
small
to join.
Small gathering, us. Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, here's one. Now, again, this is identified as an error, but you know, let's suspend judgment, listen to it impartially, and see by our current setting, is it really an error? Let's see. Okay, so this one is under the category of indifferentism and false tolerance. And it says this: every man is free to embrace and profess that religion which, guided by the light of reason, he shall consider true. Every man is free to embrace and profess that religion which, guided by the light of reason, he shall consider true.
And what the Pope is saying there is that's an error. That's wrong.
Correct.
Right. And just to be clear to listeners that just tuned in, we are reading from a book that's a compilation of papal documents from the century. So this is the Pope in 1860. Mm-hmm. This isn't Pope Francis that's saying that now.
Yeah, it's from document Maxima Quidem, June 9th, 1862.
Right. You know, that leads a lot of questions up to.
And it's only one sentence, so it could be kind of in and
out. But, you know, the development of doctrine and you know, what kind of changes as far as what the church puts out there over time, that's a whole nother set of questions. But let's go back to the original question here. Read it one more time.
Sure. Every man is free to embrace and profess that religion which, guided by the light of reason, he shall consider true.
Right. And this is like kind of a Catholic Jeopardy game that we're reading an error. So you got to you got to kind of turn it around backwards, that this is something that's erroneous.
Right.
Yep. So and that's hard for us as Americans. You know, we live in a country that was founded on the idea of religious pluralism.
Generally. There certainly was some religious intolerance, though, and persecution founding.
But at least the ideal.
Especially the Catholics.
Yeah.
Didn't they shoot the first priest that came off the boat? Is there something like that, right?
I don't know about that. But,
I don't know. That might be urban legend.
I was going to say, Maryland was an established colony.
Right. But they had to kind of, they weren't really welcome elsewhere, right? So every state was kind of founding its own sort of religion. Hey, that's a whole nother far afield thing. Okay, so let's go back to, so this seems to be a prohibit, this error then seems to be a prohibition against religious pluralism.
Exactly.
And it seems to me it also brings up a question of one's conscience, right? What role does one's conscience have? Because it's the last part of it says, that he shall consider it true.
Right, exactly.
So someone's following what they think is true religion. But this would say that really, if I were to invert it from an error to maybe what might be a proclamation of a true statement, might read something like this: every man is not free to embrace and profess that religion which, guided by the light of reason, he shall consider true.
Right. And it's not just, you know, I think we have to qualify. It says that religion. So it's not talking about, you know, different aspects of belief or you know, questioning certain doctrines or dogmas. I mean, this is, you know, a wholesale religion that it's saying, you know, even if it's an error, a person's not free to embrace an erroneous religion.
And profess it. So that could be, I wonder, so here's might be a modern day example where some of that might be going on. Really no longer here in the U.S. I'm not aware of any cases in the U.S., but I do believe in Russia, which is an ostensibly Christian, has at least a Christian heritage to it, and Orthodox Christian church that has some level of activity in it, and an alignment and support by its central government.
Correct. Yeah,
does have restriction against Jehovah Witnesses
and also Catholics.
And they don't like it. Yeah, the Orthodox tend not to like Catholics.
Now Catholics are, you know, you're tolerated there, but you're not allowed to proselytize if you're Catholic in Russia.
Right.
So if you go in and you want to bring other people out of the Orthodox faith into the Catholic faith, you know, that's not only frowned upon, I think that's illegal.
Right. Well, then there's other countries too where you have the dominant or prevailing religion, say Islam, a lot of Islamic countries. By Islamic countries, I mean where the religion is stitched into the constitutions of their articles of their government. Certainly have all kinds of prohibitions against religions that are not Islam, that a part of Islam.
Right, and I think there's a personal note to this as well. You know, I think we've got a tendency as Catholics to not be evangelical enough. And so, you know, when we meet somebody else that's of a different religion or a different faith, you know, we kind of have that attitude of, oh, okay, you do you, I'll do me, and we can coexist. And what the church is saying is, no, it's not okay that this person is proclaiming a religion other than Catholicism.
Well, just a question. Here in the U.S. and, you know, in the Western world, there's been this move towards spiritualism, that we can know what's true and what's right and everything else without God, and that, you know, we can learn these things on our own. Isn't that a fallback to the old Gnosticism that the church faced in the early years?
Yeah, that's one of those repeating, recurrent heresies that seems right to come up, you know, and yeah, I think that's Gnosticism and the New Age kind of tend to go hand in hand, that the New Age tends to be more of a new Gnosticism. And you know, I think what the error here is, you know, that if somebody comes and they profess that, that's okay. And what the church here is saying is that, no, it's not. So now that we've kind of established, okay, this is what this catalog of errors from the 1860s is saying. Now, Tim, we got to discuss this and say, is this true?
Well, I would say I would say it is true. Now, how one might prudentially try to adhere to it in, say, a political sphere is where I think the debate's going to lie, and where reasonable people can reach different conclusions. So the American experiment obviously is very different than almost any other country in the world. So it plays out differently here, let's say. But I would say, I did want to bring up, I think the reason why there is that's an error is this. It's about the salvation of souls. In other words, I think what that error is, by calling out that error, what it's pointing to is this, that there are false religions, and we can debate which ones would maybe fall in that category, and false religions lead one towards damnation and one's soul being in jeopardy of being lost. And by so the adherents of that religion, of false religion, are in danger, and then eternal danger, which is far, always seen as far worse. Eternal damnation is far worse than what anyone would face in this life. So it's the top danger that there is. And then on top of it, adherence to false religions, this gets to that word profess, try to draw in more followers. So that's pulling people away from true religion to false religion. So that had kind of been seen analogous as like a spreading of a kind of deadly virus, like we have coronavirus going on right now. It's kind of like that. It's like, what would you ought to contain a kind of virus from destroying or causing deadly harm to one's citizens, and the church especially has an obligation to safeguard souls. That's it's the sacrament of salvation is Holy Mother Church. So I think that's what's going on.
Yeah, now all that being said, I will say that since the 1860s, history has borne out and shown the danger and how severe it is to violate another man's conscience.
Correct.
And so, you know, I think over the 20th century, you know, this was written in the 19th century, but over the 20th century, we can see that not only is a person's soul in jeopardy when they are forced to violate their conscience, they tend towards sin, they tend towards mm-hmm. doing things because they think they're right.
Right.
Even if they're in error, they think they're right, and that's going to lead them to do sinful things. But the person that's trying to force the other person, even if they are right, has a tendency towards committing mortal sin. And so you wind up with a twofold jeopardy of souls by mm-hmm. violating somebody else's conscience. And, you know, I think the severity of that and how that plays out, you certainly had the French Revolution, where you saw a lot of that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, perhaps the church could have learned a lesson looking at it. Of course, the church was on the receiving end
of the persecution
in the French Revolution. But, But as the 20th century plays out and played out, I think the church kind of began to recognize, you know, violating conscience is a severe, severe thing. And there's severe consequences on the salvation side of things.
Great jeopardy in doing it.
And so I think the church, and I think some of the documents of Vatican II, we were talking about this a little bit before the show, I think they reflect that a little bit, that the church is recognizing violating somebody else's conscience, trying to force somebody to do something against their conscience, has consequences that we may not be intending.
Right. And there's, and again, it's, yeah, there's a lot of layers to this. So another kind of, I guess, couple of points to that would be, it reminds me of that masterpiece by Vaclav Havel called The Power of the Powerless. So here he is on a Czechoslovakian under the boot of atheistic communism behind the Iron Curtain. And what's his appeal? What is the power that the powerless, those being oppressed, trampled on by the socialist communist regime, what power do they have? It was the whole essay is about our power is our conscience, because the conscience is the one place that an oppressive state can't reach, right? And so that is a huge turning point. And one might argue here, and I know we're coming up on a break, that the whole 9 days when the newly elected Pope John Paul returned to Poland was this awakening and stirring of and tapping into the Catholic conscience of Poland that then launches the downfall of communism in Eastern Europe.
And we're going to take a break and we'll come back. Take a look at maybe some other heresies and some other disagreements. That
I got a book of them, buddy.
And we'll be back with more of The Catholic Cave right after this.
When it's easy to give up, don't. When it's easy to give in, hold on. When you're thinking you're about to give out, ask for help. Catholic Radio Indy.
Late Night Catechism is coming to the Paramount Theater in Anderson this Saturday, February 8th at 7:30 p.m. This sinfully funny play will take you back to your grade school days. The New York Times calls it uproarious interactive theater. More information and tickets are available at andersonparamount.org or by calling the box office at 765-642-1234.
And welcome back once again to The Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell, Kent Blandford, and we are having fun reading through a list of modern errors and a list of papal encyclicals and papal documents on errors that the church over the centuries has identified that in a lot of ways we in modern times have adopted, society-wise, culture-wise.
Made peace with, if
made peace with, kind of are stewing in these errors and we may not even realize it.
Right. Not sure it's a good idea either. So that's why it's good to talk about
them. You know, we were just reading one on religious pluralism and kind of pointed out that, you know, it was written at a time where the church, there have been new developments, and there have been new developments in doctrines around conscience that were spelled out in Vatican II that may not necessarily be reflected in the error as it was listed in the
Syllabus of Errors
from
1864.
Exactly. Okay, so what's our next error to discuss?
Okay, well, I'm going to throw one out there because as the recording of the program here, it's a Catholic Schools Week. So here's one pertaining to education. See what you think of this, guys. Okay. Catholics may approve of the system of educating youth unconnected with Catholic faith and the power of the church, and which regards the knowledge of merely natural things and only, or at least primarily, the ends of earthly social life.
Uh-huh.
You want to hear that again?
Yeah.
Let's hear it one more time. You ready? There's a lot there because I think we've done this actually quite a bit. Catholics, so again, this is an error. So it's saying this statement is in error, according to this document, church, papal encyclical. Catholics may approve of the system of educating youth unconnected with Catholic faith and the power of the church, and which regards the knowledge of merely natural things and only, or at least primarily, the ends of earthly social life.
Quick question.
Oh.
Do you have a date specific to that?
Yeah, this is from the Syllabus of Error, so December 8th.
That particular...
1864. Yes, okay. It's number 48.
Number 48, and okay.
Yeah.
Yep. So 1860s, and you know, and I the church to this day continues to urge parents to enroll their children in the Catholic school systems,
mm-hmm.
and or you know, if your child is in the public school system, you as a parent need to be sending them to some sort of Catholic faith formation to be able to round out their education. So the church continues mm-hmm. to a certain extent to assert that just a secular education divorced from your Catholic faith is inadequate. And it's going to lead to certain distortions and certain errors that you really need to get a full rounded education to be mm-hmm. able to navigate and mitigate.
Well, and the biggest thing is right now, since the 1960s, it's not that public education has been divorced from the Catholic faith. It's been divorced from any faith.
Correct. That's right. And so I would say, so this raises a lot of issues around like what this error would seem to be pointing to. So going back historically, what do you see, at least in the American setting, you see it about that time, this huge impulse of what building parishes and parish schools in the United States.
Right.
I mean, and that continues for, you know, probably 80 more years.
Yeah, and in Europe, you see an establishment of secular schools.
Correct.
That are rivals of the Catholic school systems that were in the European countries. So you're beginning to see, you know, you're beginning to see this push for secularization, particularly in the universities, to kind of push the religious dross aside, as I think what mm-hmm. the attitude was, to get to, you know, the nuggets of pure reason. And so I think that's a lot of what that's reacting against too.
Right. And I think you're bringing up a good point around, okay, so you have, say, so we would call them public schools. They're secular state schools, what they really are. So a public schools, they may, one of two things may be going on, maybe more, but two I'll point out. One might be that the public school, as you were kind of pointing to, Mark, could be insufficient or lacking in the kind of moral and holistic project of liberal education. And certainly they're not teaching any Catholic theology there either. So it could be just that things are missing. The other, another thing I think that's happening, the second important feature, I think parents will see this, and even students of certain age and up, is that the public schools or secular state schools actually teach error. So it's not just that they're leaving stuff out, but they're actually indoctrinating, or by indoctrinating, at least promoting certain sets of ideas and understandings that are antithetical to Catholic identity, Catholic moral social teaching, et cetera.
Right, and I think that brings up a question, because if you look back at 1864 when this was written, and you look at the status more in America probably, and maybe in certain European countries, what you had were state schools that were not, they were still religiously affiliated, but they weren't Catholic. They were teaching Protestantism.
Correct.
And so, you know, in some ways the church's reaction to that is, no, it's not okay to send your kids to a Protestant school if you're Catholic. If you're Catholic, your kids need to go to a Catholic school so that they're getting Catholic theology and not a different religion. And I think mm-hmm. that's kind of what you're hinting at too. And in some ways, our current system right now, where there is no religion in school, is a compromise. It's a compromise between the idea that, you know, we should have sectarian religion in it versus, you know, a different type of sectarian religion. So rather than that, we leave religious education to the parents or the churches and the public schools. To kind of reflect the plurality that we were talking about, are going to kind of stay out of the religion business, and we'll leave that to parents to give them religious instruction. So the question is that better or is that worse than having religion in school that may not necessarily be Catholicism?
That is the question, right? Because I think I would say, kind of at least in the American setting now, there's a large I'm not saying the majority of the population, but there's a significant part of the population that would like to see some agreement reached on what the common ground is, common set of understandings across at least the mainline Protestant denominations and the Holy Catholic Church could come up with, and then perhaps have in the school system. But I don't know. I mean, just the restoration of one's ability, say, to pray or carry a Bible to me seems reasonable. Or the other thing, I think another reasonable step is in a secular setting is to where the curriculum, where they want to institute this in their curriculum, the Holy Bible is worth study from a scholarly standpoint. And so studying the Bible as an important text, because one might argue, I don't know which any other text that's had more influence on Western civilization than the Holy Bible. And so there could be room for that. But I think there's a kind of cautiousness that we ought to exercise, because if we were to cede space to religious initiatives in the public school, that could quickly turn into, in different school systems, into a whole variety of different religions that, again, we were kind of talking about, we wouldn't be happy or pleased with. Like, for example, I wouldn't want, a Catholic family, parents who are trying to raise their kids Catholic, wouldn't want them to be going to a public school where the religious component is forming them to become Muslim, for example.
Right, right.
Because it's a different kind of project.
Right, exactly. So, you know, the church's teaching and position now, though, is as a parent, you are the primary educator of your child, and it's up to you, no matter what school they're going to make sure that they are formed religiously as Catholics and have that religious formation. And whether you're getting that through some sort of parish-based faith formation program, or whether you're getting that by sending your kids to the Catholic schools, you as a parent still have that responsibility. And in that case, I would say that what they said is an error in 1864 is still an error today. You can't be indifferent to your child's religious formation and religious, I guess, what he's getting at school.
I'm going to throw one more out there. This is another good one for discussion. Okay. Again, syllabus of errors. Here's one. Again, the statement is identified as an error. That this is really for an American especially. Okay. The church ought to be separated from the state and the state from the church.
Ah, so separation of church and state
is an error.
And I would say, you know, there's an argument to say it's an impossibility. The idea that you are going to have in America, what's the ideal? That we are a government of the people, by the people, for the people. So to have separation of church and state, and I think this is what some people are arguing, to have separation of church and state, you have to have a non-religious people. Right. If it's a government of the people, for the people, by the people, and the people are religious, then that religion is going to be reflected in their laws and their governance. Correct.
Right. I agree.
Right. So the only way to have a separation of church and state is to make the people secular.
Yeah. Which lots of great thinkers have pointed out, especially in some of the writings of our founders, for example, but others would say what that would precipitate is the collapse of the ability to have a democracy, because the people would be what? Immoral.
Right, right. So, you know, the ideals of our country are that we don't have an established church, that we don't have a church. And once again, it's an established...
Yeah, the Church of America.
And the original idea was in a church established by the federal government. You know, there were established churches in the various states well up until the 1820s, 1830s.
Oh, yeah.
So you had established churches that were, you know, the churches of various states.
Yeah.
And they were considered perfectly constitutional and in accord with the First Amendment of the Constitution. It wasn't until later that we decided, well, all the states have to follow what the federal Constitution says in regards to these things. But I would say even following that idea of no established church, that doesn't mean that this strict separation of church and state is what the error is pointing to, that the error is pointing to something much more severe.
I think in some ways that might be, stepping away from theocracies,
Right, right.
So we need to take a break. We'll be back with more on the heresies and the difference of opinions over the centuries. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Keep Jesus at the center of our day all day long by having those words in the background.
It touches lives. It does every day.
Have you been married and have since divorced? Do you think your marital status prevents you from coming to church? Most Catholics and non-Catholics unfortunately have a lot of misconceptions about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Pope Francis has recently encouraged all people with questions about marriage to make an appointment and talk with their parish priest. As Catholic priests, we look forward to the opportunity to help you on your journey through life. Please make an appointment to speak with the priest today. We are and will always be here for you.
Think of all the media our young people are exposed to today. MTV, movies, what passes for entertainment on TV, song lyrics that are questionable or worse. Where do they hear the message that it's okay to be chaste and modest, or that it's not crazy to practice their faith, or to believe in a God who loves them and can forgive them no matter what they do? Catholic Radio is the answer. Be sure to tell your friends and relatives about Catholic Radio Indy.
You can hear the Holy Mass every day at 8 a.m. right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell and Kent Blanford. And we are reading through the 1864 Syllabus of Errors that the church put through. And we're discussing some of the more controversial ones. And in 1864, the Pope said that the idea of a separation of church and state is an error. Separating church from state is wrong, and as a Catholic, mm-hmm. you are in error if you believe that we should have separation of church and state, which kind of would seem to put those of us who are Americans in a bit of a bind.
It sure does. Well, I think what again, what I'll go back to something on the liturgical calendar that we celebrate every year, which is Christ the King. And I think if we again that. We're just picking one-liners, right, kind of from these various papal documents. Out of this great book that we've been using, The Popes Against Modern Errors. Now, you know what? I know we just had Christmas, but this, those of you who like to like plan early, this would make a great Christmas gift for that Catholic in your life.
Especially if you're the Catholic in your life is a reactionary Catholic.
Right. If you're listening to this show, if they listen to this show, they probably will love the book.
Or it'd be great for Easter as an alternative to candy.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's
maybe
right.
Maybe for Lent. Maybe there's a good
ooh,
Ash.
Ooh, Lent. Lent.
We
ooh.
Should bring in the idea of Ash Wednesday gifts.
There you go.
There we go. Something to read during Lent. Right. It should be a book. There we go.
That's right. And so Christ the King. So I think what the Holy Father here was pointing out, Pope Pius the Blessed, Pope Pius the Ninth was trying to point out in that particular error is that we ought not to. Christ is the King of the universe. He's not just King of heaven, he's King of heaven and earth. And we need to make sure that we're acknowledging his kingship in our lives. And so that leads me to this other, let me throw in this one, because this might be, this might advance the conversation a little bit. Okay, here we go. This one's number 56. Okay, this is under the section called Errors Concerning Natural and Christian Ethics. Okay, you ready? It says, moral laws do not stand in need of the divine sanction, and it is not at all necessary that human laws should be made conformable to the laws of nature and receive their power of binding from God.
Yeah, see, this goes back again to the one we started with, which is the idea that theology is a science,
mm-hmm.
and what the church really teaches, and I think this is to a good extent true, it's the first science. In other
yes.
words, it's the one that sort of establishes the principles from which a lot of these other sciences ought to come. And that's what the church mm-hmm. is pointing out about ethics, is the study of ethics and its relationship to theology. Now, does that mean that you can't find ethical and moral truths apart from theology? No. No, you can explore them, but I think when you explore them back, you always have to be mindful that this is going to have to connect up. If the mm-hmm. universe is built the way we as Catholics believe it is, this is going to have to connect up with what has been revealed to us through divine revelation and through the science of theology this is going to have to connect up with what we know about ethics and who man's created to be, what man is destined for. And so that should affect the way we live. And so therefore it should inform and be the basis for our ethics.
Yep. I think a way I've come to think of it and share it with others is, again, we're talking about natural law, right? Natural law theory. So again, thinking of like rungs of a ladder, as a kind of hierarchy of laws. And there's four rungs in that ladder. The lowest one where we started are human laws, so those passed by human authorities, so legislatures, things like that. The next rung up and of higher authority is what is called natural law. So natural law are the first principles we can know by the light of reason, by reflecting on what it means to be human and have a human nature. So this would be things like the first principle would be do good, avoid evil, procreation, take care of your offspring, education, because every human being desires to know, et cetera. So natural law. And that connection right there comports with, we're not too distant from Martin Luther King Day. And in his masterpiece, Letter from Birmingham Jail, he makes the explicit appeal of this, that the laws that had been passed, the Jim Crow laws that had been passed duly by legislation in some of the southern states, were laws on the books, true, but he said they were unjust laws. How was he able to make that claim? Well, his argument, it's a very Catholic argument, and in fact, that letter appeals to Augustine and Aquinas, is this: the natural law presides over and is the rule by which one measures the just or unjustness of human laws. And he said laws of segregation, for example, violate the natural law. So let me go to the other two steps of the ladder. So human law, lowest rung on the ladder. That next rung up is natural law. Next law from there is divine law. So those are the things that have been revealed to us by God. And then top rung, fourth rung, is what's called eternal law. And that's sort of the cosmology that pertains to God, the metaphysics that pertain to God as being a sovereign ruler of all of creation.
Right.
And I think so all those have to line up. And that's helpful because that tells us when human beings make mistakes, we make errors. So we pass a law, like a law that does what? Say enshrines slavery, right, as a human law. Well, how do we know that's an unjust law? Well, we can, because it violates natural law, divine law, eternal law, things like that.
Right, and I think there's a second part to that, especially when you talk about a universal cosmic law being something kind of above and beyond divine law. So you've got the revealed truth that's revealed to us through religion, and that's kind of what when you
sacred scripture is a great example of that.
But you also have other issues that are moral and ethical issues that aren't addressed by sacred scripture, and the idea that we can make pronouncements that are in conformity with the divine law without reference to scripture is because of this makeup of natural law that we have access through human reason to what human, like smoking, for instance. Like, you know, smoking is an ethical issue. It affects health. It affects the health of others, etc. Nowhere in the Bible does it say thou shalt not smoke.
Correct.
You know, there's no reference to it in the Bible, right. But yet it still conforms with the divine law because it's part of human law that is in conformity with that eternal law that sits up and above divine law.
Yeah, one might say, one might be, I think maybe where you're going is this, the our principles are to be found in the natural law, and it comports with revelation, it comports with sacred tradition with a capital T, and because they're principles, we're able to reason our way through how we apply those principles as new things emerge as we move forward in time. So, right, there's no prohibition, there's no explicit prohibition using the language of in vitro fertilization anywhere in sacred scripture. But we would say, though, one might be able to reason back to the principle back into scripture about the nature, as you were talking about the nature, what it means to be a human being, our destiny, and how and why a very modern or contemporary sophisticated technological procedure like IVF is a violation of principles that we can trace back.
Right. I think another important qualification with this is the church is not teaching, nor has it ever taught, that everything that's in divine law must be legislated into human law.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, you know, true. Yeah,
you know, there needs
Augustine makes that really clear in the City of God.
Exactly. There needs to be room for liberty. There needs to be room for freedom. There needs to be room, to a certain extent, to err and sin. I think, you know, St. Thomas Aquinas even makes that claim explicitly, that, you know, people to a certain extent need to be allowed to sin if keeping them from sin is going to cause greater harm. So if you're going to be violating people's conscience, if you're going to be violating people's property, if you're going to be causing a whole bunch of other societal harm to try to get people to act morally, then that really shouldn't be in the positive political law of the city or the people.
Right. So I would say an example of that, and this brings up this issue.
Smoking, I think, is a good example of that. But
so smoking, so I would say pornography is one where, although I would say there is far more we should be doing to restrict its use and its promulgation and its production and its exportation, because the harm it causes to the human person. But imagine trying to have a law enforcement mechanism apparatus that would completely eradicate, say, the consumption of any pornography in the United States, and which, you know, is really next to an impossibility. I mean, the level, the size, the level, the intrusiveness, because of how available it is, how much pornography is out there, the devices by which one can access it or warehouse. I mean, it's just to make that happen would just, as you said, would probably cause far more harm to society than the good of it if it were able to actually reach its goal.
Right. And this brings us full circle back to the error that we started with, which is it's important when you're talking about it that way that you're not falling into that error of making human reason on par with divine theological, divinely revealed truths.
Correct.
In other words, you always have to keep in mind that even if you're of the belief that, you know, it would cause way too much harm to try to eradicate pornography, you still have to keep in mind that pornography is wrong. It's evil.
Correct. Right. Whether you've got the state of Indiana says so or not.
Right. Exactly. I think a lot of people look at positive law and they say, well, you know, if it's legal, then it must be okay. If it's legal, then it must be good.
And generally that's true, or ought to be true, that because law is a teacher, and that's why bad laws are so harmful.
Right. Generally it's true. But people do fall into that error, I think, of just because it's legal, that means it's moral. No, there needs to be room. I mean, I think within any human system, there's going to be room for immoral things to still be legal. But it's up to us to follow our conscience and not do those immoral things, even if they're still legal.
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And guess what, though? We have just barely scratched the surface on this is just the section.
You mean there are a lot more modern errors out there than we've talked about?
Oh my gosh, we are in for it. But this has really been a lot of fun because, again, you used the term heresy earlier. Errors, heresy are rarely new. They're not all reoccurring. They're like if a new one does emerge, it is likely to pop up from time to time. So this has been helpful. I hope for everyone listening really enjoyed at least us beginning to take a little survey, if you will, of what modern errors are and what some of the popes have said about them.
Yeah, and just a reminder, Lent is coming up in about the next month or so. So, you know, if you want something to read through, some studying to do during Lent, I might recommend The Popes Against Modern Errors, or even Old Error and New Labels by the Venerable Archbishop Fulton J. Sheen. Just something to consider. Take a look at our modern world through the lens of a number of folks who were there long before we were and much wiser than we are. So that's all the time we have for the Catholic Cave for today. I'm Kent Blanford for Mr. Mark Tuttle, for Timothy O'Donnell. Be holy.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400. Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.